Hey friends, welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing in the background. Every week on this show, we try to talk to somebody interesting from the world of guitars. It could be a player, it might be a guitar maker, or maybe a guitar historian. And I gotta be honest, obviously I did not anticipate having to do the episode that we are doing right now. But with the passing of the incredible guitar hero, Dick Dale, earlier this week at the age of 81, I wanted to pay tribute to him somehow on this podcast. Dick is somebody who I always thought we would feature in the Fretboard Journal at some point. I kind of struggled with what would be an interesting angle or what would be an interesting perspective. Dick told a lot of stories, and a lot of those stories had run in the other guitar magazines over the years. And honestly, one of our goals is to feature stories that haven't been told a lot. And so I talked to Dick about being in the Fretboard Journal. Obviously, I was way too late on this. And I have a feeling, though, as the years progress, we'll be featuring Dick and his music in our magazine in some ways. I'm sure there is a way to do him justice. For this week's podcast, I wanted to talk to a few different folks who either had perspectives on Dick that maybe you weren't familiar with, or just a good story to tell. And so I'm interviewing three people who I know pretty well and who I thought might offer an interesting perspective for you guys. First up is my pal, Matt Warshaw, who is literally the historian when it comes to surfing and surf culture. Matt has authored the book, The Encyclopedia of Surfing. He now runs the Encyclopedia of Surfing website, a site that I am proudly a member of, despite having never surfed before. Matt is one of my favorite writers in any genre. I am thoroughly addicted to his weekly newsletter that I get, and I love talking to him. He happens to live in Seattle, not far from us. So I brought him down here to talk to us a little bit about Dick's place in surf history and surf music's place in the culture of surfing's history, and I think you will enjoy that. Next up is our always delightful pal, Jim Washburn. Jim has been a frequent Fretboard Journal contributor over the years. Besides us, he's written for the LA Times, the OC Weekly, BAM, and a gazillion other outlets over the years. He is the author of Rhinestones and Twanging Tones, The Look and Sound of Country Music. Yes, a book that combines Martin Guitars and Nudie Suits. He is also the co-author of Martin Guitars, an Illustrated Celebration of America's Premier Guitar Maker, and he is also the author of the very cool Martin Archives book and a bunch more. He's got a lot of dirt on Dick, I guess you could say. He spent a fair amount of time with Dick Dale over the years and interviewed him a few times, so he has a pretty witty perspective on all things Dick Dale. I think you will love it. He also has a very priceless story about spending a weekend with Dick Dale and Jonathan Richman at Dick Dale's place. So you will want to tune into that. And then last but not least is John Page of John Page Guitars. Obviously, John has, you probably know his name from Fender Guitars and the Fender Custom Shop. John is now in Oregon, and obviously during his stint at Fender, had a few run-ins with Dick. So I wanted to get John's perspective as a guitar guy, guitar maker, on the podcast. So I hope you enjoy all these interviews, and maybe you have a Dick Dale story of your own that we could compile for a future Fretboard Journal podcast or article or something. Not much else to report. We're working hard on the Fretboard Journal 44. Subscribe if you haven't yet. As always, the Fretboard Journal is 128 pages of long-form interviews and photo essays and histories that you won't find anywhere else. Definitely not online. You can go to fretboardjournal.com to subscribe. And I should say, if you are listening to a podcast about the music and times of Dick Dale, you should probably listen to our other podcast, The Truth About Vintage Amps with Skip Simmons, because we talk about vintage Fender amps probably for an hour every other week on that show. So check that out. I'm the co-host of that podcast as well. So if you're not sick of my voice, go over to iTunes or Stitcher and check that out. All right, without further ado, here is our very small tribute to the amazing guitar hero, Dick Dale, whose music had such an impact on all of us. And what a career. You listen to those early Dick Dale tracks that have the saxophone and sound so thoroughly 50s. And then you listen to Miserloo and it's like, wow, he opened a portal to another side of the world of guitars that we're all the better for. All right, up first is my talk with the amazing surf historian, Matt Warshaw from the Encyclopedia of Surf. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. All right. Well, yeah. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So, Matt Warsaw, you are, I would say, the king of surf history, and the king of surf guitar just died. So that's why you're here.
Yeah, Dick Dale just died. I saw him perform once at this really twee San Francisco Sunday show called West Coast Live that I would go, we would go now and then. When my mom was in town, I would take her. It was sort of a fake, it was sort of a knockoff of Prairie Home Companion.
Okay.
And they would have a lot of authors on there, local artists and stuff. And I don't know who got the, and it, the show I think would start at 10. And I don't know what guy or what, you know, what sort of perversely funny person within the booking part of that show decided that Dick Dale would
fit, but wake everybody up.
Well, that's what he said. He came out barefoot. This was probably in 92. He came out barefoot, kind of shambling out there, and just leaned into the microphone and said, "We are here to wake you up." And you've seen him. I mean, he...
Yeah.
It was... Like, it blew the... I mean, like, physically, it was so loud. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking... I was delighted. My friend Mark Reniker, who I was there with, also who also surfs, we just lit up. I mean, we're looking around to see all these middle-aged and senior San Francisco people who were there to, you know, listen to Annie Lamott or whoever was, you know, they were people literally with their hands over their ears. And I understood, but it was, God, it was awesome. You know, he was still really in great health at that point. And it was only a two or three song set, but it was amazing. And we talked to him afterwards. You know, if Dick was around, he would talk to anybody.
Sure.
Or answer any email or pick up the phone if you called the number that was at the bottom of his website. He was pretty available.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So was that your only encounter, like face-to-face encounter with Dick Dale?
That was the only one when my assistant and I were working on getting information for the Encyclopedia of Surfing in 2000 or 2001. I remember Nathan, the guy I was working with, it was really, I gave him a list of 1,000 names that he had to call everyone who was still alive from surfing. And
sure.
Dick was on there. And it was really fascinating about who wanted to talk and who didn't. You would get some people who would just be very monosyllabic and yes, no. And Dick was the other side. You know, once you got Dick started.
Yeah.
But Nathan, who was, he was a guitar fan, he was thrilled. Eventually hung up the phone and looked at me and said, "That was Dick Dale. I've been talking to you for the past 90 minutes, you know." And he was really excited. And, you know, Dick had his greatest hits of stories as well as his greatest hits of songs. And he was just telling Nate, you know, you would just get him on the, "How did it get started?" And he would unwrap the story that he'd told a few days ago to whoever, the last person that called and asked him how it got started.
Yeah.
But he was generous that way. And he was very funny. And he just brought all that drama to it. He brought the drama to the music, and he certainly brought the drama to the storytelling. And I don't know, you know, very cliche, but there was, you know, they broke the mold. There was no one else like that.
Yeah.
At least not in surf.
Yeah. I mean, talk a little bit about, I would say generally speaking, surf music as a genre is not necessarily played by surfers at all, but supposedly Dick Dale did surf, right? Or was that another?
Well, I I was just reading my own entry on him before I came over here, and he was born in Boston, I think, raised in Boston, right?
Quincy, Massachusetts.
Yeah. And he moved, it was funny, I read two things, one that he moved to my old neighborhood in South Bay, which is sort of southwest Los Angeles, the coastal area down in a place called El Segundo. But I also read somewhere that he moved to Orange County. So I'm not sure where he landed in California in the 50s.
Yeah.
But he landed, and, you know, he was like kind of a greaser, right? I mean, that, you know, he was...
Yeah.
But he did what you did if you wanted to be a cool kid in Southern California at that period, and he started surfing. And I don't know how good he was, but I think he was out there. And there was, you know, John Severson, who founded Surfer Magazine, shot the picture of Dick for the cover of Surfer's Choice. There he is on the cover of his album, standing, riding a wave. So he could do it. It always looked a little funny when he would pose with a surfboard, because he literally looked more natural on the album covers where he's doing the drag songs with he looks more like the car stuff, right? I mean, yeah. I always kind of found this to his credit. He never tried to look like a surfer. He never tried to look like anything except what he was.
Yeah.
There's pictures of him with a surfboard, and you can see he's just got he's got his hair greased back, and I kind of love that about him, that mm-hmm. he wasn't trying to be a surfer with the bushy blonde hairdo or anything.
And what was the scene? What's the ballroom? The Rendezvous.
The Rendezvous.
That was the where he legendarily, booked it for multiple nights or whatever. Kind of did the DIY punk thing before you could, where he's booking his own venues and stuff. What was that scene like?
Well, the Rendezvous ballroom was beachfront in Newport Beach in Orange County, and it was a real big deal, really big deal in the big band era. So my mom went to spring break there. It was called Balawi, because I think it was Balboa Island. So okay. Balawi, and I think you would see, you would see big band, like big name, big yeah. band guys would play there. And then I think, and then it burned. I think the Rendezvous yeah. might have burned two or three different times.
Okay.
And then they rebuilt it, and then it was kind of in disrepair again in the mid-50s. And the police were getting a little bummed out because of the amoral rock and roll was starting up.
Sure.
Apparently Dick Dale and maybe his dad went down there. Dick had got his band started. I don't know if it was called the Deltones yet, but they had to sign papers or something saying that this would be a respectable show, and that they would just play, they would not play rock and roll or something. And Dick tells the story where, they, to make sure that everyone was dressed appropriately, he went out and bought a box full of clip-on ties. So, as the kids would come in, you'd get a tie to clip on. And
wow.
Again, legend has it, and by legend, I mean the way Dick Dale tells the story, like 17 people showed up for the first show he did, and then everyone's sort of sitting down while Dick goes through his whatever the his country western or his yeah. pop stuff. And then I think at the end of the set he snuck in a couple of hotter numbers.
Yeah,
he wasn't doing the Miserloo stuff and like that, but he snuck in some rock and roll stuff. And the next time he played there were 30 people, and then there were 75, and it sort of grew. I don't know how many years he was playing at the Rendezvous, but that became a big deal. If you surfed in that area, Orange County, or probably LA or San Diego counties, word on the beach was you had to show up at the Rendezvous on whatever night it was, Fridays or Saturdays, to catch Dick Dale.
Okay.
And when I was trying to piece this together, a lot of this was happening, I think, before he had gotten big into the real wet, heavy reverb thing.
It was
mostly instrumental, but I think he did a lot of, I think his thing then was a little more varied. There was more stuff. I think he was a pretty big country western fan. You will know more about this than I would, but I think he played a lot of country western.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was still doing sort of pop stuff, but the instrumental stuff became more and more popular. And then Let's Go Trippin' was the song that I guess got labeled as the first surf song. And about that time,
yeah,
supposedly he was given the nickname the King of the Surf Guitar.
Yeah.
But then, to me, the real cool stuff doesn't happen until, I don't know if Miserloo was the first one where it got really heavy. But
yeah,
because Let's Go Trippin' to me doesn't quite click with me.
Yeah.
At least not the way Miserloo does, which still to me just makes me shiver. And
yeah.
Yeah. So and then there was this connection with Dick, and again, like I say, the John Severson, who founded Surfer Magazine, I think he was going to a lot of those shows. Surfer Magazine was founded in 1960 because Severson was hired to do the graphic design and the photography for Dick's first album, and there was a bunch of other sort of promo photos that John Severson shot too. So he was involved, and you know, all those guys at that time or a year or two later were really the first people that really didn't like the vocal surf music, the Beach Boys stuff and Jan and Dean. They hated that stuff.
Okay.
And they all, you know, almost, it's almost like the hatred for that stuff, I think, probably bolstered how they felt about Dick Dale and the Ventures and
yeah,
the legit surf bands, which, you know, sort of by definition to them, was instrumental and gnarlier, heavier, like, yeah, like you said, like, you know, it's a little, almost like the punk of its time.
And I know a tiny bit about this era, but like, I know there were guys like Warren Miller and Bruce Bowne making surf films.
Right, right.
Would Dick Dale's music be played in the background, or what were they doing?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I've got all those films on a hard drive at home, and you've just completely stumped me, because I don't think that there's Dick Dale music on any of those movies. Early on with Bud Brown and Bruce Brown's early movies, Bruce Brown's the guy who made The Endless Summer.
Yeah.
A lot of what they were putting on there was, it was a kind of jazz. What's that jazz? The guys who were playing at the Lighthouse in Hermosa Beach. There's a name for it. Not California jazz.
I know what you're talking about, though. Like Bud Shank.
Bud Shank, right, yeah, right. So they used a lot of that. And then there was John Severson, who's made surf movies before he started doing Surfer Magazine, he loved using, who's the guy that did the Peter Gunn theme? You know, down, 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 down.
Sure,
down,
sure. Down. Well, Bob Bain played guitar on that, but it was, I'm spacing.
Yeah, so yeah, that, yeah, you know, that, and, but now I'm just stumped as to why Dick Dale's music wasn't used in those movies from that period. I don't know, because all those surf movies stole the music they were putting on the soundtracks. I mean, so what, you know, why wouldn't, when did Surfer's Choice come out? Do you know, 62 maybe?
Yeah, something like that.
God, there were a ton of movies coming out then. I don't know why. I don't know, yeah, why, but, you know, surfers loved them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And then did, was there a, obviously, Dick Dale kept playing and reinventing himself and overcoming health obstacles and all the other stuff. But, was there a cooling off period where surfers started to think surf music wasn't for them or anything, or did the two things part?
Yeah, when did when were the Ventures at sort of their biggest? Like when 63 or 4 maybe?
I think 64 probably, yeah.
I feel like there was a point right around then, like surf music, when surfers were really into it, was a little bit before that. So when Dick Dale was playing at the Rendezvous in, let's say, 59, 60, or 61, it was really a surfer thing. Like, I don't think anybody else was listening to it, on this. And by the time the Ventures were making music, and I think Dick Dale was still doing some of that stuff, I think surfers were listening to all that music more or less along with everybody else. Like, it just become sort of a big thing, and a lot of surfers were also listening to a lot of R&B or a lot of just top 40 or something.
Yeah.
So I think maybe once it got identified as surf music in the newspapers and magazines, and I'm just sort of guessing this, but it might have been a thing where, oh, well, if they're onto it, then we're going to kind of just listen to it, but it's not going to be it's not our thing anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm making that up, but it didn't seem like, you didn't see the surf magazines in that period interviewing the king of the surf guitar. And I don't really know why.
Yeah.
He was still playing a lot right then.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit unable to help on that one.
Can you think of any other well-known surf music players who actually surfed?
No. No.
Okay. So Dick will always have that for him.
Yeah. I don't know. I part of me has always thought that Miser Lou was so good that the genre almost like built in its own sort of extinction, or not extinction. It built in, it had this high point that was so high that there's stuff that comes after it that's good, but to me it's like it almost peaked. That particular song and Dick's version of it was so good that where could you almost go from there? Wasn't much. There wasn't much room to go anywhere from there. You
can't have more reverb. Can't have.
Well, yeah, and if, you know, you listen, you line up the 10 best instrumental surf songs, and everything comes. Everything's just vying for second place after that song. And I'm what year was that? I've got it on my site somewhere, but I'm guessing it was either 62 or 63 or something. So. Yeah. That could be part of it, that it just, it, Dick Dale, you know, did something so great early on that it didn't have anywhere to go.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of talk this last couple of days about what a sort of good person he was, and he was a blowhard, and he was a storyteller, and he loved sort of the sound of his own voice and all this. But a friend of mine emailed me this morning to remind me that a famous California surfer named Chris O'Rourke had got cancer, Hodgkin's lymphoma, it was a fatal cancer that he was fighting, and there was a fundraiser for Chris, and the guy who got in touch with me today called up, just cold called Dick Dale, and said, "We're having a benefit this weekend." And Dick Dale and the band just rocked right up and played it, no charge, and you know, made thousands for them. And there was another great story I heard this morning from a woman named Linda Benson, who was, U.S. women's champion surfer in the 50s, late 50s. And she was on the set of Beach Party, which Dick Dale's in. I think it was Beach Party, one of those beach blankety movies. And Linda was one of the stunt doubles. She was still very young. She was probably 18 and didn't have a car, maybe didn't even have a license, and said she needed a ride back to... I think it was Leucadia, which is in San Diego, and they were, you know, they were doing the movie in L.A. And Dick just volunteered to, you know, to drive her home, and it wasn't anything pervy.
He just
said, "Oh, come on," and you know, put her in his huge black Cadillac and with some other people, and they just drove, and you know, she got to hop out of the car to see her folks after getting a ride home from Dick Dale. So he apparently was a guy. He was a genuinely good guy. He just. Maybe that's because he never did get as big as... He never became a giant, huge star. It's almost like he sort of stayed in touch with who he was before he was famous.
Yeah.
I don't know why he didn't become more famous. Maybe you know something about that. He didn't like touring, right?
Well, he had a bunch of setbacks, you know? I mean, divorces and health setbacks and, you know, kind of almost did like the... what a Rat Pack member would do. Like, he opened a lounge, right? You probably know this. He bought like the Playgirl Club or something. And
in L.A. or
somewhere down there, and turned it into a Dick Dale lounge. And like, but every time he'd kind of get to that level, then he'd have a kind of a setback, you know.
Isn't the legend that he was dying of cancer when Jimi Hendrix recorded Third Stone from the Sun? You know that story?
I think he had cancer then. Yeah.
So, that's like the weird song on Are You Experienced, and through all of the distortion and noodling and all the weird stuff, I think Hendrix kind of mutters, "You'll never hear surf music again." And the legend was that was because Jimmy, who used to go to the Rendezvous to watch Dick play, and I know that both of them played their guitar in a
left hand, they flipped over,
Supposedly that was because Jimmy in the studio had heard that Dick Dale was about to die, so he threw that little psychedelic tribute in there, and then, you know, next thing you know, Dick's beaten all odds and lived for 42 more years. So it did seem like he, and you know, he also raised, he had huge cat. He had lions and tigers at his,
yeah.
I mean, full size, like, big cats,
yep.
in Newport Beach. And there's these pictures of Dick Dale, like, snuggled up to, like, the biggest tiger you've ever seen. And I'm just thinking, God, he, in a way, he was cheating death always.
Yeah.
Play with
pilot. All that
yeah,
stuff.
All that yeah. stuff. So it's you know, when, and there was the, whatever cancer stuff he was going through 3 or 4 years ago that he was talking about. It's, I don't know, you know, you'd kind of been expecting to hear that Dick Dale died from, I mean, going back to whatever it was, 67. It seems like,
yeah.
on one hand, yeah, sorry to see that Dick Dale died this weekend, but on the other hand, geez, I think he lived decades past when a lot of people would have thought. So
yeah.
good for him. And I saw, you know, I saw a clip of him yesterday when I was just online looking around, and it was from late last year, so late 2018, and he was playing pretty hard. You know, it was yeah. there was a chair on stage, so I think he was sitting down at parts, but he was standing up, and sounded loud as hell, and he was playing Miserloo, and it, you know, his fingers looked good, and
yeah.
Did you see that quote from 3 years ago when he said. He said, I'll never die laying down or something. He said, I will die on stage in an explosion of body parts.
Yeah.
So he didn't get to do that, which would have been great.
Yeah.
But he did have shows booked all through this year. So he'd intended to
yeah.
get better and keep playing. So he died with his pick in his hand, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. That was Matt Warshaw. I hope you enjoyed that. And now here is my talk with Jim Washburn. You want to talk about Dick Dale a little bit?
Yeah, why not? Okay. Where should we start?
I don't know. Where should we start? I mean, Jim, it seems like you guys crossed paths, you and Dick, a few times over the years.
Yeah, quite a bit back for a while. Shall I start where I first even heard of him?
Sure.
Because, you know, a lot of people assume in Southern California that he was a legend, even if people hadn't heard of him elsewhere. And maybe so, but a legend a lot of people hadn't much heard of. You know, I think I was maybe 12 before I ever read anything about him, and that was in a rock and roll history that Barrett Hansen, better known as Dr. Demento, wrote in a magazine called Hit Parader. And they had a photo of Dick there playing the flipped-over Stratocaster, and I thought, that's interesting. And a few years later, I found like that first album for 25 cents in a pawn shop and thought, that's worth listening to for that, and kind of fell in love with it. And saw him live, I think maybe once in the 1970s, which was a huge disappointment because he would do kind of grudging, obligatory versions of a couple of his old surf songs and was mostly doing this sort of let's go up to rock and roll heaven oldies review thing where he'd, you know, hop around and play trumpet and drums and the whole clown show, basically, and okay. wasn't much fun to see. Somewhat later, around 1980, everyone's friend Steve Sost, and also Richard Smith, better known now as the great guitar author, were in Dick's band, and slowly convinced Dick to maybe get back to doing what he used to love doing. And by around 83, he was doing a lot more of his, you know, what he was best at, which was just pounding the hell out of a guitar and making it sound like a wave crashing over you. And that's what really hit me about his music when I started listening to it when I was 15 or so on that first album, that, and he later said this is really just what he was aiming for, was to kind of create not so much music as the palpable sensation of, like, these waves in nature kind of crashing over you. And he did that. Just great, I thought.
Yeah. I did not know of his oldies review years, so that's interesting.
Yeah, it was a pretty large band, and they all had outfits, and he had his wife Jeannie on tambourine and vocals and things, and it was odd. If you've ever seen, like, the photo of him where he's naked holding the Stratocaster in mm-hmm. front of him.
Yep.
With almost like extra Beatle length hair on. That was from like in the 70s when he owned a club that I think he called the Rendezvous after the old ballroom that he had played in Newport. And it was just, you know, total review time and all that. You know, just kind of something fit for Vegas, and he might even played Vegas, I think, a bit, but I'm not sure on that front. But, you know, very much like that. And then it really took Steve Sost and Smith and these other real fans of the old music to finally cajole him into back, you know, getting a smile on his face and playing. And that was fun.
Yeah.
And I got to know him just a tiny bit from that, you know, where he might basically notice me if he saw me again. It wasn't until I was a rock critic that he really noticed, because I wrote nice things about him at a time when, you know, most people weren't really paying attention. And it was funny. He was this fabulous personality in ways, though annoying if you were interested in things like the truth. Because he, you know, I think he always had a pretty good handle on how important he was in music, even if the rest of the world didn't. And maybe he expanded on things a bit to kind of fill that gap. I don't know, but he was one of the first phone conversations I had was after I'd reviewed a show of his and loved it, and he calls up and we're chatting. And I was just interested in the whole surf culture and the beach culture in Southern California, so I asked him if he knew Hobie Alter, the guy who created the Hobie Cat and all this other sort of ocean sports stuff. And Dick said, "I think I know what you're asking, Jim. You're asking me, could it be that Dick Dale, you know, the first person to feature a surfboard on an album cover, created almost single-handedly this whole crazy surfing craze that swept across the nation and even the world, where people in small landlocked towns were buying woodies and driving around with a surfboard just to be cool? You know, could that have all been because of me? You know, now that you ask, yeah, maybe, now that I think about it, maybe so."
That's awesome.
and that was kind of the first taste I had of his sense of invention about things, which, you know, when he was just a local guy, I and the other writers around Orange County just kind of knew to leave that stuff out. And when he became kind of a national figure again, was getting press after Pulp Fiction, it got a little problematical, because by then he was really expanding on things. And there's one kind of infamous interview he did in BAM magazine where he talks about helping Leo Fender to shape the Telecaster and helping to design the Stratocaster and this sort of stuff, which he was, you know, back in junior high and high school in Quincy, Massachusetts when that stuff was going out of here. And just sort of detracts from what he did do, which was, you know, be a nice testing ground for the Showman amp when Leo was developing that. You know, whether the genesis of that amp started with Dick, I don't know. I think probably Leo was trying to more follow along with what Standell was ahead of him in doing in the way of piggyback amps and JBLs and things. But Dick was certainly the proving ground for it. And, you know, originally he might have claimed he blew up 8 or 10 amps till Leo got it right. By last count, I think he was saying it was 40 amps. But, you know, whatever it was, he had, you know, a big influence in making Leo realize the way things were going, and to come up with a louder, more durable amp that would hold up to Dick Dale, who was indeed rough on equipment. You know, his style of playing was really loud, really bassy, really percussive. And I could see that tearing up a lot of speakers, particularly old Jensen's that started to kind of blat out on a low E note. So grant him that. And Leo did, I know, try out some of their equipment on him. He was, you know, he certainly got early reverb unit. And he was also testing out, I don't know if you've ever seen that short-lived FM transmitter receiver thing that Leo marketed for guitars. And Dick used one of those for a while, though I guess it wasn't too reliable, using basically 1961 technology. So there was that. And I'm sure, you know, I noticed his band seemed to get kind of first pick of Jaguars and guitars like that when they came out, though he couldn't stand them, Dick himself. He disdained anyone playing anything but a Stratocaster. And also when I got to know him back then, we were talking about some of the other surf bands like the Shantays and all. Very nice guys and great musicians, but Dick's opinion was their puny little fingers can't even fret the strings I use. Which was true to a point, because, you know, Dick played, what, 16s to 58s. Sometimes I heard when he could get them, his low string was a 60. And those weren't easy to bend. You know, even when you were playing upside down and had that expansive fingerboard that you could pull the high treble strings over, very hard to bend. And something I thought was really curious, years after I got to know him, Jonathan Richman, and I stayed with him out at his house in the desert. And Dick's Play Around the House All the Time guitar was a 60s Martin D28 Brazilian rosewood back, not that he cared,
yeah.
that he strung with nylon strings.
Wow. You know,
upside down, of course. And that's what he played around the house. And he said he mostly really liked playing country around the house, which was kind of where he started, too. Something else a lot of people don't know, that, you know, assume he just sprung from the ocean. You know, where he used to hang around, like, was it the Hometown Jamboree or whatever up in L.A., like the big country show, and was on their talent shows a fair amount and all. And I think Deke Dickerson, you'd have to ask him, but he might have even suggested that Dick kind of got the sound of surf music a bit from some of those pickers, because, you know, Joe Mavis and those guys, you know, Jimmy Bryant could sure pick the hell out of things in a real fast percussive manner when they chose.
Sure.
So there was that. Dick used almost entirely downstrokes and demanded that his band do so. That was part of his sound, all that really fast staccato picking. He's using downstrokes. And if you've ever seen the picks, he used like a heavy white pick, and he would kind of melt them. He wouldn't wear them down. They'd actually sort of melt at the edges just from the friction of his attack. And, you know, Steve Sose, when he was in the band, you know, just that upstrokes, downstrokes, what's he going to care? And, you know, when Dick was, you know, when they were rehearsing and Dick was facing the way, he'd try alternating, and Dick just stopped playing immediately, turned around and said, only downstrokes. Where he was really on top of that sound that he wanted.
Wow. Quite. I had no idea.
Yeah. My favorite period for him was actually after that. He pared things down to kind of a power trio. Ron Eglet on bass, and I think Steve Ashoff on drums. And they would just fly. They would pound it out. He didn't, maybe in the olden days he had, but by this time in, like, you know, late 80s or whatever, he was not using a set list. And he would sometimes change keys and things and just expected the band to be right there with him. And when there were only two other guys, you know, it was a lot easier to do than having six guys up there with horns and everything. And it was pretty wild and rambunctious. And one show he played at this big cavernous gym at UC Irvine was a memorial show for Leo Fender with all sorts of people on it, like 13-year-old Joe Bonamassa, the Yngwie Malmsteen, who mainly had a crying fit because they didn't get the precise Marshall amp he demanded. And then Dick Dale just came out and was like a thunder lizard. It was like an astonishing show, just, you know, like louder than hell and crazy, flying in the moment. You can almost hear pterodactyls screeching around the hall and that big, great rumbling surf and all that stuff. It was kind of magical, you know, in the way that nothing else was there. Where, you know, if Leo Fender had been there, I think it would have been throwing up a lot of the evening. But, you know, would have loved that part of it.
When was the last time you saw Dick?
Perform maybe 12, 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And he was great then. He had his son, Jimmy, playing a little bit with him then, though he was pretty young and all that, and just still sounding great, you know, shredding, would sit down a little bit during the show, but otherwise just going like forever, and still really, really good. I didn't know him at all beyond a certain point, because we had actually a falling out when there was that article in BAM magazine where he was, you know, talking about co-designing the Strat and all that stuff. I wrote in the magazine and said something to the effect of that Dick's reality is too great to be contained by the mere truth, and kind of and set the thing straight a little bit. And then he wrote back and said, I don't know who this pipsqueak Washburn thinks he is, but I was there and blah, blah, blah. And he seemed to entirely forget that he'd known me for years and things. So I mainly just saw him from the audience after that.
Yeah. I got to ask, what happened on that Jonathan Richman weekend at his house? That seems like it's made for a movie or something. I can't even picture this.
It was pretty funny. We were both in awe of him, of Dick, to a degree. And I had actually, because Jonathan had never seen Dick Dale and was a big fan, I thought, I can fix that. And got a concert promoter friend of mine to book a double bill of them at two clubs down here. And the first show, they really liked each other, but their audiences couldn't stand them. Where Dick Dale's fans are coming up after John, you know, we're kind of heckling during Jonathan's set and all that stuff, and coming up and telling, you know, the club owner, you know, who booked this clown, you know, to open for Dick Dale? I mean, this is preposterous. And then some of Jonathan's fans felt the same. And all I know, that was a little awkward, but they liked each other and hit it off, and we went out to Dick's house out in wherever, 29 Palms or wherever it was, his Sky Ranch there. And we just stayed one night, but it was odd. You know, one of the first things Dick did was show us what his dog could do, where he had a small surfboard in his pool there, and the dog would just jump from the edge onto the surfboard and surf across the pool. And that stuff. He didn't have any tigers at that point. I think that a tortoise might have been as exotic as it got. But the strangest part of the day is they were both kind of martial arts aficionados, and got to talking. And the next thing I knew, we were moving furniture around so they'd have room to spar. And for like maybe an hour, hour and a half, they went at it, kind of furiously. You know, is it? You know, with Dick, I'm sure it was like an ego thing or something like that. Where, you know, Jonathan was certainly more spry and in better shape and all that stuff, but Dick had this great bluster where he'd just come at him and all that stuff. And it was sort of scary to watch, but no great harm done. And then Dick kind of showed us around and all these things, his scrapbook, and then told us about this movie he wanted to make about his life, which takes about 2 minutes to relate, shall I?
Go for it.
Okay. It was curious. In the first review I did that he'd really noticed when he called me, I'd likened him to Thor, the god of thunder, where, you know, Strat was sort of like his hammer, that he'd just hammer the thing and thunder and all this other crap would emerge from it, as opposed to anything like logical music, in a sense. And he liked that. And anyway, he's telling this story where this little kid goes to the forum to see this big guitar hero guy named Thor. Not Dick Dale in this story, this long-haired guitar hero. And the kids, you know, is waiting to get the guy's autograph afterwards and doesn't. He's really disappointed. Is when he's leaving, he sees the guy's limo there and slips in there and sticks a note in with the decanter there and leaves. And Thor, the big guitar hero, is riding off from the successful gig and sees this note and looks at it and says, "You're not the king. Dick Dale still lives." And the guy has this big fit and says, "Who's this Dick Dale? I'm going to show him. Yeah, I'll tell you, I'll invite him to a show, and I'll blow him off the stage. I'll destroy him, but I'll make him think it's in his honor," and blah, ha, ha, sort of stuff. But he has to go searching for Dick, because Dick has almost left this world. No one knows where he is, and he has to search the world for him, and finally hears rumor that Dick's a hermit up in the Himalayas, and goes, starts heading up there with these Sherpas, but they all fall away, cowering and terrified, because from on high they hear all this thunder and lightning sounds and wild animals making these horrible screams. But this guy soldiers on his own and finally reaches the peak. And this is Dick recounting the story just like this. And he says, and the first thing he sees is this yellow generator going, or generating electricity. And he sees a cord going from that to a blonde Fender Showman, and going from that to a blonde reverb unit, and a cord going from that to a Stratocaster held by a man wearing a weathered serape. And he's playing this screeching and astounding music, and on all the surrounding peaks, there's like bears and wolves and other animals gathered shrieking along with them. And that was his idea for the movie. And the guy, of course, realizes that Dick's, you know, the superior player and a great human being and all this stuff, and convinces to come back and be a hero again or something.
Wow.
And that's how Dick kind of saw himself. And, you know, which is a little bit part and parcel of him always speaking of himself in the third person. And after, I suppose I sound like I've been dumping on Dick for half an hour, probably because I have, but it's also, I should leaven that with the fact I think the guy was sort of a musical genius, in the sense that he created something that wasn't there before, and it kind of did spring from his brow. You know, you could find antecedents of all a bit of this he took from that and Bo Diddley here and things, but he sure made it into something that was nothing but him. You know, you could tell from two notes maybe that you were hearing Dick Dale. and that it was something special. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful for that. It's just, you know, when you dealt with Dick for years and years on the local scene, and I'm not the only critic to have done so, it got interesting.
Yeah. I can't think of too many guitar heroes who have a personality quite like this. I wonder, was he ever friends with Evel Knievel? It sounds like they would get along famously.
You know, not that I know of, but I would think they would have. That or they would have wound up moving the furniture and going at it for hours.
Well, if he's willing to spar with Jonathan Richman, yeah, I'm assuming anyone's game.
Yeah. Yeah. And almost everything he did, you know, kind of had to be larger than life, and maybe it was. You know, he told me he used to, he played a place called the Pavilion Ballroom that was right on the beach in Huntington Beach. And between sets, he'd say he'd have his jammies on. Between sets, he'd go running out and just surf, you know, for 20 or 30 minutes and come back on stage dripping wet and start playing. And one night he's doing that, and he's like all this wet and stuff, and he's singing and, he's singing and playing guitar, and then he gets a zap from the microphone.
Sure.
And he didn't realize how bad it was until a moment later when he's playing trumpet, and he said that blood was flying out of the bell of his trumpet into the audience. And maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
I wasn't there for that.
It's a good image.
Yeah. I mean, there's people, you know, Gene Simmons couldn't do that.
No. Say that again. Yeah. Jim, I knew you'd have stories, and you delivered.
Well, good. I hope you're able to make something of it.
I hope there are pictures of the Jonathan Richman weekend, but I'm guessing there aren't.
Not a one, I don't think. It didn't even occur to us. Yeah. Jonathan wasn't much of a photo sort of guy.
Yeah.
You know, I've known him for decades and decades and might only have 3 photos with him or something.
Well,
but that's for another podcast, maybe.
Yes.
I love his guitar playing.
Yeah, it's incredible. Well, thanks again for being a part of this, and look forward to your next contribution to the Fretboard Journal magazine.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, that was Jim Washburn. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly had a blast talking to him about Dick Dale. And now here is my chat with John Page of John Page Guitars.
So I know a little bit about your story, and man, we need to feature you in the magazine at some point. I know that's not the reason I'm calling now, but your life is like made for a screenplay or something.
I love your magazine. I would be honored to be a part of it, but yeah, I've been around for a few decades.
Yeah,
I go way back.
And I guess apropos of talking about Dick Dale, you kind of grew up in Southern California surfing, right?
Yeah, and that's why Dick was such a major influence for me, and actually became like, you know, a friend too, because he used to befriend all of us young dudes. So I used to surf the wedge quite a bit, and in the early days, you know, he had the mansion right there on Newport Beach, right on the jetty of the wedge. So, like, any time, you know, we'd go down there and surf, hey, you got to stop by. And, you know, that's when he had his tigers and all that kind of shit. And it was pretty cool, man. He was a crazy dude.
And how old were you?
I was young. I mean, you're talking, when I first met Dick, I was 21, maybe.
All right.
So, going back to 78, maybe, is when I first met him. He still had the place in Newport at that point. And up probably until... one of the divorces happened whenever that, then he got rid of that place. But yeah, when I remember him coming to Fender in his, he had this, big motor home with this huge mural on the side of him surfing, playing a Strat, and Dick Dale, King of the Surf Guitar, you know? And I remember shit. I mean, here I am, this kid that, you know, grew up with his music and used to surf and, you know, dreamt of him and the Del, you know, and then, you know, the Beach Boys and all the other, you know, surf icons of the time. And here he is coming up to Fender, coming in to talk to us. And I remember being totally blown away by that motorhome.
Yeah.
And probably back then he was going in to see like Freddie Tavares and probably Ed Johns, because he was usually coming in for his amps back then.
Okay.
So, but yeah, then I saw that motorhome like years and years later. We were filming a BBC documentary on the 40th anniversary of the Strat, and they wanted to do my interview out in the desert, and they were going to do Dick, go to Dick's place and burn this giant Stratocaster, you know, on his airfield.
Okay.
And I remember going out, you know, to Dick's that day and seeing that same motorhome, but like totally dilapidated and faded. Aww. And his old gold Rolls Royce, and just thinking, oh man, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, I don't want to be depressing, but almost the classic rock and roll.
Yeah.
Story, you know, rags to riches, riches to rags kind of, you know, thing.
Yeah.
But,
it's a lesson for everybody out there. RVs and Rolls Royces tend not to age very well.
Yeah, especially like 70s RVs with massive graphics on the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you were younger, did you actually go? Were you brave enough to go to his place outside of the surf break and see the tigers and everything?
Nah.
Okay.
Nah. I you know, even at Fender, I wouldn't normally do that stuff. I mean, unless I was directly invited for a specific thing. I always tried to be, I think probably Freddie and everybody, you know, of that older generation kind of burned that into me to be the, you know, consummate professional.
Yeah.
So like, I rarely took pictures with people. I didn't do that kind of stuff because I knew it was a business relationship, you know. And as friendly as it was, I still knew it was a business relationship. So,
yeah.
I never stepped over those bounds.
So, did you ever get to work kind of alongside him on guitars or anything custom shop related?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I can't remember where he, I think it was something like kind of an odd place he played. Like, I think it was a restaurant club my wife worked at, and he was playing, and I went out to see him, and I hadn't seen him in years. And that's when it hit me that, you know, this dude really is an icon. I got to get, and I was running the custom shop at that point. It was still pretty new. And I went back and talked to Dan Smith and Bill Schultz and said, look, I really want to do a Dick Dale signature Strat. And, so that's why I introduced the idea to them. And, you know, Dan was from New York. Other guys, you know, like Bruce Boland, who was marketing, also was Nashville. They weren't part of the surf scene, you know, they were blues and country kind of a thing. And so, you know, me being the SoCal, kid, it was more like, you know, well, okay, cool, surf music. And, but anyway, so they said, yeah, sure, no problem. That makes sense to us. And so, I brought Dick in to do that project. And then I had, John English spear that one up because he was, you know, like me, Orange County, surfer kid, knew Dick too from ever, you know, cause you just run into people like that out there.
Yeah.
And, so John actually took that project on. I do remember, when we reintroduced it at NAMM show, I wanted to make a splash. And I remember having seen Dick, when he did his big stage show, when he was still married to Jeannie. And they did this big, like, Hawaiian stage show. And so he had the exotic, you know, like hula dancers and stuff going off on the stage and all this kind of stuff. And then he would come running out when he gets introduced. He would come running out with a surfboard under his arm and then turn the, you know, put the surfboard on end and turn it around. And his guitar was embedded in it. And then he'd pull it out. And the, you know, tech would come out and grab the surfboard. Then he'd start playing. So when we introduced his guitar at NAMM show, I made sure the guys went out and bought a surfboard and we cut it out and hollowed out. Just like, you know, Dick introduced. Well, I remember seeing Dick introduce himself on the show. So that was kind of cool. But yeah, I mean, you know, we worked, you know, hand in hand on that, although that was John's daily thing. You know, that's the weird thing about being the boss in some of those situations. You know, I'd put the party together and then I'd have to leave and somebody else would you know, take it the rest of the way.
Sure. What were some of the unique details on that guitar? Was it a pretty run-of-the-mill kind of custom shop Strat?
Well, I wouldn't say it was run-of-the-mill by any means. I mean, yeah. It was, I mean, it was a dupe as close as possible to his 59, but also it had to be reversed, because even though it was just a right-hand guitar, if we just did that, it wouldn't catch the nuance of it. So we kind of had to do a left-handed, right-handed strung that way, so it'd have the reverse angle pickup, and have the sharper top end, tighter top end, sweeter bottom end. His controls were all plugged out. I can't remember exactly what he had for controls. I think a volume control. Everything else had these little metal, plugs in to block the other controls. But other than, the fact that it was reversed for a right-hand player to emulate what he did, it was pretty much a nuts copy of his guitar.
Wow.
Less 9 different paint jobs or whatever. we went right to chartreuse sparkle. We didn't repaint it 50 times like he did. But it was an awesome guitar. It was just fun and funky. And we knew it was going to have a limited market appeal, but that really wasn't the impetus in doing it. It was more of a recognition of him as a historic artist, the kind of impact he made in the marketplace, the kind of impact he made at Fender. I mean, the development of the amplifiers would never have been as powerful if it wasn't for Dick saying, no, I need more, I need more, I need more. So even speaker development, stuff like that, I don't know that would have happened, at least at that time, without Dick. And then his whole playing style, kind of like being the father really of heavy metal music and everything else, the speed and the intensity and the percussiveness, and it didn't matter that he still was playing, county fairs and restaurants. It was like, yeah, but he's playing constantly and he's still this iconic cat, Yeah, that's why we did it. Glad we did.
Yeah. Do you get the impression that, by the time you met him and the custom shop project, was he pretty happy and content with the gear he had in front of him, or was he still kind of tinkering and looking for new sounds and trying to fix things?
I mean, going back to even the 70s, he pretty much was playing the same thing. When he'd come in and he'd see like Freddie and Ed, I don't know that he was necessarily sculpting anything. It was more like to make what he had live. I'm thinking of Custom Shop even. It was still pretty much the same thing. The Showmans and the reverb head, and I mean, he added wireless, but other than that, I think that's about it. He loved his tone. It's a pisser that John English is passed away, because as far as more specifics of the instrument stuff, he would have been the guy to talk to, but unfortunately he's passed away as well.
Yeah.
But only because he worked hand in hand with Dick and Dale and that. Hey, years go by, we're all kind of bipping off one at a time. So.
Well, I'm glad you're still with us, and we'll come down there and do the full interview and everything.
I'm happy I'm still around.
Yeah. So what's the latest at John Page Guitars?
I keep designing and building here in my shop in Oregon. And then I have a partnership with a company called HRS Unlimited, Howard Swimmer out of Pittsburgh. And I have a production line of product as well now. So it's my designs, but made, to where it's more affordable. Howard actually was one of the guys who started Premier Builders Guild, 10 years ago, whenever it was. And then he left that, and so we started this. And so it's nice because I build 12, 15 guitars a year. That's about it. And with the production, I'm able to get product down a lot more affordably and a lot more of them, which is kind of nice for me as a designer. It's nice to see your product out more. But it's cool now because I have projects that range from like stupid expensive art guitar piece I'm working on to a brand new bass development for this giant guy, 6'7" bass player who, wanted me to design something from scratch. So it's fun, it's kind of like, it's the things I always used to do, except at Fender, I had to design, keeping in mind, okay, we need to make, you know, 30,000 of these or something, you know. And when I did the custom shop, it was cool because it was like, okay, we got to design or build one of them. And that, I loved that. And so I'm kind of in the middle of those two things now. And it's, you know, it's, for me, it's perfect. And, you know, I stay in the forest. You know, I pretty much turn into a hermit. I go out maybe once a month. I volunteer at the local high school. They started a guitar building program, which is pretty neat. So the high school kids building guitars. So I try to go down there and help them out. And other than that, man, it's just a slow guitar building life. I love it.
Sounds very cool, man. Thank you so much for talking to us, John. This was great.
Yeah, Jason. I hope you got something out of it anyway.
Oh, yeah. Different perspectives. It's always everyone who has who met Dick had an interesting story. That's for sure.
Yeah, Dick was quite a character, and we're all going to be a little worse for him not being here anymore. But he left us a great music legacy, so that's great.